Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is Brianna Schwartz and Alexis Schreiber, the dynamic duo behind Schwartz & Schreiber PLLC. Their innovative approach to entertainment law sets them apart as they aim to provide a true end-to-end partnership with their clients, becoming a member of their team rather than just a passive or reactive attorney that's only involved when there's an issue. Brianna and Alexis first met on their first day at the University of Miami Law School, where they were both pursuing a Juris Doctorate and a Master's in Music Business and Entertainment. After years of success within the industry, they officially teamed up in 2020 to create Schwartz & Schreiber PLLC, a modern law firm specializing in music, entertainment technology, and new media. To date, their firm has supported over 70 clients, including Grammy Award-winning and nominated artists, producers and songwriters, renowned labels, digital and tech platforms, national festivals, sync houses, and much more. During our interview, we spoke about how the new record deals have changed, how having too many writers on a song can inhibit sync opportunities, how AI is affecting copyright law, where the industry stands on TikTok right now, and so much more. I spoke with Brianna and Alexis via Zoom from their offices in Miami. Both of you have very interesting backgrounds and quite varied, actually, but yet you have a lot in common. Let's go there first. Bree, let's start with you. So give me your background.
I've been a music lover since I was a young kid. I was, the child who was walking around with my CDs stacked this high through the airport and on every vacation I went on. I started playing piano from a very young age, from 3 years old. And I danced my whole life as well. So I was always very musically inclined, but I was not talented enough to pursue it on a full-time basis when it comes to, being the actual talent. So as I got older and in college, I was working in the music industry in a sense, in nightlife, kind of essentially hosting DJs and artists that came to Florida State. There was like this big wave of the electronic music industry kind of blowing up where these artists as big as Tiësto were coming and performing in backyard barbecues type scenarios. And so I was involved in, hosting the teams and dealing with management. And when I started seeing kind of how that all came together, it was really infatuating to me. And so for me, going to law school was only a pursuit to be in the music industry. And I met Alexis the first day of law school because we were both signed up for the Master's in Music Business and Entertainment program, specifically there with about maybe five other students in our entire class, which was hundreds of students, to really just, do it full steam in the music industry. I really, for me, wanted to find a way to make an impact on the business side of things because I was always so passionate on the music side of the industry. And then when it came to law school, I started my 1L year interning for Leslie Siegel. He is Pitbull's attorney, Bob Weir from The Grateful Dead, spent some really awesome time working in the boutique realm and kind of seeing what that was like. And then from there, was like, yeah, maybe I want to be in-house at some, company that's involved in the music industry and not so much on the artist side of things. So I worked at Ultra Music Festival for about a year and a half as well. And then from there went on to work at Viacom and saw like the digital media side of the space. After law school, I graduated and worked at a boutique firm that specialized in the creative industries and kind of helped them build up their entertainment and music practice. But from that point, I really wanted to do something bigger and make a real impact in the space, which is kind of where Alexis and I reconnected. But I'll let her tell her story as well.
Cool. Alexis, so you're from Texas, right? You're from Austin.
I'm from Texas originally. Yeah. So pretty similar to Brianna, but at the same time, so different, as you mentioned. I grew up in Texas, so I was, very much into the country space, indie, kind of more folk aspect. And I grew up as a singer-songwriter, essentially writing music, playing guitar, and really found a love and a passion for that all throughout my teenage years. And got to the point, as we mentioned, where I had to make a decision whether or not to pursue that track and pick up and move to Nashville amongst all the super talented, you know, people there, or, you know, pursue the business in a different way. So I kind of decided to play to my strengths at that point, because after, you know, traveling to Nashville and seeing all the super talented people that were have a really hard time making it in the industry, even at that time, it was, you know, hard to see. And it was kind of like, okay, well, at this point, it's either do that or find my own angle in the industry. And I was always good at school. I did well in school and kind of was raised by an attorney. So I knew that aspect side of the business. And so entertainment law was a very easy in for that, where it made a lot of sense. And it would allow me to combine that passion of music with law. And so I found the program at UM, like Bree mentioned, that kind of marries the two worlds super well, and was really excited about it. In Miami, especially, because the avenues for that, it's really like, you know, you think about entertainment law and you think New York, LA, it's kind of like where your mind immediately goes. But there are also these other places, like Miami was very up and coming in the music industry at that time. They were really cultivating a great program. So that was the avenue we went down. I also worked for Leslie Ziegel for pretty much my whole law school career. It was a great learning experience and loved that space. After school, I ended up moving to New York and going in-house and in essentially like entertainment adjacent company, where for a serial entrepreneur involved in the tech space, fashion, events, hospitality, skincare, all that kind of stuff. And really had a great experience working there, learned a lot. But, you know, as Bree mentioned, really wanted to get back to the heart of making a difference in the music industry specifically and kind of how it blends with all the other facets of entertainment law. So then after that, we teamed back up after a few years of working, and here we are.
I'm curious. I saw something on your website that said the new law. You're looking at things from the new law perspective. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's funny because you're not the first person to ask us that. So the one, you know, you talk about the way that the industry has changed over time. For us, we like to call ourselves, we're consumers of our clients' music, of the festivals that they put on, of the products that they release, of, you know, the events that they throw. So for us, it's really like kind of innovating the attorney-client relationship. I guess it's multifaceted. The first part is innovating the attorney-client relationship in the sense that we are peers to a lot of our clients, and we like to kind of get down and dirty with them and think about, like, what are you trying to do over the next year? Like, why are you securing this deal? Like, does this make sense? Like, kind of talking them through the actual, like, business side of the negotiation and what it is they're pursuing, as opposed to just being paper pushers, as, you know, some lawyers are called, where it's just like, you know, hey, here's the deal. Can you review it and tell us what this means? So for us, it's really like relating to our clients and showing that we're a partner and not just this unrelatable advisor. And then the other aspect of it is that, you know, the industry has changed and there's a lot of trends and things that need to be acknowledged in drafting these contracts and negotiating deals that didn't exist, you know, 5-10 years ago and are rapidly changing, even just the way that music is being consumed by society.
Now, I know what those trends are, I think I do, but that being said, that doesn't mean that what I think is a trend actually coincides with what's going on with the law portion of that. So tell me what you see in law and entertainment law that's changed in the last 5 years that needs to be addressed, that you're addressing.
I think yes. The trends do, they do, you know, the trends that you're thinking of also have influences in the law career, in the law legal field as well. So even how music is consumed. So by streaming, all these different aspects that are changing the game allow us to be more creative in how we, you know, make deals. And Bree can explain that a bit more.
Yeah, so it's like if you break down the way that society consumes music and content, like Alexis said, from streaming to social media marketing, to digital marketing, to even festivals and the opportunities that artists have from a visibility standpoint to get their music, you know, out there to the world. It really impacts the way that we go into deals. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's more innovation that goes into crafting deals these days. Whereas back in the day, it was like, okay, there's a record label deal, and these are the terms that are going to be dictated, and this is what we're going to discuss. We're seeing record label deals now that have something called step outs. And what that means is, okay, you're exclusively signed to this label, but you're able to release a few songs with maybe more niche independent labels that fit your brand a bit more, because you want to reach a specific audience. But it's like, that doesn't necessarily make sense for all artists. That doesn't make sense for all labels. But there's really, I guess the point is, there's no standard like there used to be. People will come to us and say, well, like, what's normal for a producer deal? And it's like, well, what genre are you in? What's your leverage? Like, what's your history? Where are you trying to go? And who are you negotiating with? And I think in the past, things were a bit more laid out, where now there's opportunity to kind of craft and innovate your own. Like, we say to our clients, like, you have a vision in your mind, we can find someone to help secure that deal, as opposed to having that person come to you and you having to take what they put on the table. Because if that person's not offering you the right thing, we will find help you find someone who will.
Well, you mentioned leverage, and leverage is a big deal these days, because most major labels anyway are not going to sign you until you have some sort of visibility and some sort of, well, level of stardom to a degree, and you don't have any leverage until you're in that at that point anyway. So I think it's important that, in fact, that artists should know that. Are the artists that you deal with, are they aware of where they stand in terms of the hierarchy of being signed?
Yeah, we absolutely help them, you know, kind of determine that as well. That's definitely something that comes with experience and all that kind of stuff. But as you're saying, artists now have a lot more control over their leverage than they did in the past. Before, it seemed to really rely on where they were signed, who they were able to connect with, just really organically. Whereas now they can control their own audience. They can reach people a lot easier than they could in the past. And their geographic limits are a lot broader than they were before. So artists are able to create that leverage in a way that they never were before. And we always encourage that. Even if an artist is signed with a major label or any kind of label, we're always telling them to continue to advocate for themselves, continue to build up that leverage and push themselves and broaden their audience on their own terms, as well as, you know, using the labels and like the machines behind them, because it only helps them make better deals in the future and gives us that bargaining power on their behalf as well.
And I think in defining leverage for us, leverage is really about the extent of opportunities that exist. So like, if you think about leverage in just the current deal that you're looking at, sure, you know, maybe you don't have much wiggle room. But if you look at the sense that there are 7 other independent labels that would potentially sign me and I will be able to own my masters, as opposed to bringing this to, you know, one of the majors. And then we're actually dealing with this with a young client right now. And we had to sit down with her and say, you know, this is what the deal says. These are the risks. This is what this means. If this is what you want, then great, we can move forward. If not, there are other labels who would allow you to retain your masters and who would allow you to have more creative control over what it is you're releasing. So I think leverage is just really understanding the opportunities. And by increased leverage, I think that the way the industry is moving has provided increased opportunities for artists and the industry as a whole.
Let's talk about songwriting for a second, because I have a question that I've wondered about for a long time. And it has more to do with hip hop. You'll see as many as, and I've seen 22 songwriters on a song. I've always assumed that it's a cover your ass type of thing, where it's like, if you're in the room, you get credit, so no one comes back later at the real creators. Is that the case? Or am I wrong on that?
No, it's funny. I'm laughing because one of our very first clients was a Latin record label, Mr. 305. And we saw this a lot, where there were no, numerous, you know, 10, 20 artists on one song, and the split sheets were super, super long. And it would be people ranging for with percentages everywhere from 50% to like 1.25, like something super tiny. And so for us, we found it can be genre specific, where there's a lot of people that tend to contribute to a song and be in a room. And it's a lot more common in certain genres than in others, where maybe like, you know, in pop or in something like that, it's fewer artists in a room. I think there is an element of a cover your ass type of thing, where it's, if you're in the room, if you're there, absolutely. But at the same time, we always ask about contribution. It's not just about who's in the room. It's more so, what did they contribute? You know, how much did they contribute? What was actually included in the final, all that kind of stuff. And we make sure that those are all discussed and negotiated and papered up or documented in an agreement before the song comes out, as you know, as many times as possible. So I think there is an element of that, but it is funny because it does happen very often. We see it a lot where it's not just who is in the room. It's also like, oh, my friend, you know, I want to give my friend a piece of it. And this person, the list goes on and it gets crazy.
One of the problems with that, and I've had several music publishers on, when it comes to sync, it's finding everybody and getting the clearances from everybody, especially if they all have their own publishing companies. So that limits the sync possibilities in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So it's funny you mentioned that, because we actually represent a few sync houses that are running this new model where they are pre-clearing and pre-approving music to put in a catalog to then pitch to ad agencies, film producers, you know, the works in that realm. And when they're looking to secure music, they're looking for as few writers and as few publishers as possible, because like you're saying, clearing a sync with seven writers on it, meaning you have to go through seven writers and then seven different publishers, is very, very complicated, especially if some of them, you know, are majors. So it's interesting, because it's like, sometimes you're almost inhibiting licensing opportunities when you have that many people involved, because the clearance alone is just so costly and so expensive that, you know, we've had scenarios where the brand or the agency is turning down the opportunity because it's just too much of a hassle to clear.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Good. You confirmed it. Okay. Let's go here. AI. And I want to.
Everyone loves AI.
Love talking about AI.
I want to drill down on AI copyright, but first of all, I want your thoughts, Alexis. Let's start with you. Just give me your thought on how AI is influencing what you're doing right now.
Sure, I think it's influencing everybody to an extent, and I think for us, we see it all the time on the legal front, where people are able to ask certain questions, get responses quickly, and there's so many different ways to utilize AI that some are really scary and some of them are awesome and influential. And in our business also, we like to stay ahead of it and kind of understand how it's being used, what are the capabilities, you know, where is it going also, because that's another important element to this whole thing. It's like, not only just how is it being utilized right now, but it's also having a little bit of foresight in where it's going, and especially when advising clients. But I think in the legal field especially, it's the question is always like, oh, is it going to replace, you know, attorneys? Is it going to replace artists? Is all that, you know, is it coming for everyone's jobs? And it's the interesting part of it is, as Bree was mentioning before, because attorneys are getting more and more creative with deals now and getting creative with negotiations and responses and things like that, I think it does allow us to utilize it as a tool rather than, you know, an end all be all, and create these, you know, interesting deals and different angles and things like that that we can use with artists. And so I think it's the same thing on the artist side too. It can be used as a tool rather than just like a straight end where the AI creates the music and that's the end of it now. So it's just an interesting dynamic, and it's going to be very cool to see where it goes.
Have either of you used Vincent? Are you aware of it?
No, we haven't.
Not. No.
Vincent is a large language model that's specifically for attorneys. It's trained on court cases, and it was developed by Damien Real, He's a cutting edge IP attorney who's also a programmer.
Very cool.
you should check it out because I've seen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, looks like it's something worthwhile.
Yeah, there's a few of them that are trained on court cases. There's what plugin for is a ChatGPT plugin now too that specifically is trained on case law. That again, it's the reliability of it is still pretty questionable. Like I definitely wouldn't take it to the bank by any means, but it's really interesting as far as like quick answers, things like that. It's been very interesting to see where it goes and even to double check sometimes the technology and kind of see where. What questions you can ask it and how you can double check it, that kind of stuff. It's really interesting.
If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can find out all about my books, including The Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, AI for Music Production, The Music Mixing Workbook, The Music Business Advice Book, and more at bobbyosinski.com. There you can also read excerpts from all my books, learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter. That's bobbyosinski.com. Have your clients been using AI in music creation? And if so, what problems is that creating?
Yeah, so when AI, first started coming up in the music space, I don't know if you remember, that Drake ghostwriter scenario.
Oh, yeah.
So, around that time, we had a client who was very interested in utilizing voices in the way that, ghostwriter did, but except not to exploit for the purposes of like generating revenue. Utilizing voices to exploit. He's a producer artist, but a very Grammy nominated producer multiple times over. And he, really wants to show the world how good his production is. And so his thought process behind it was like, I can use these voices to pitch demos in a much more efficient way than I could to like be singing on the track myself. And so interesting enough, after he, kind of called us about this and was really interested in utilizing it for some A-list artists and songs that he had that he wanted to pitch to them, David Guetta started speaking about this as well. And it's very prevalent in the electronic space because you have a bunch of producers who are able to create these phenomenal beats, but, aren't necessarily, talented from a voice perspective. And so kind of providing the ability to show the world like what their production is. And we've had questions of like, can I put this on social media? And that's where like, it's tough because it's like, you don't want to tell a client no, but we like to err on the side of being conservative in regard to the law and almost treating AI in the sense of like a sample where like, let's like go ahead and like obtain authorization, obtain clearance and like help like boost the industry from a licensing or revenue perspective when it comes to AI, as opposed to like stealing from people. So for us, it's really about teaching our clients, like you can utilize AI as a tool, but you cannot utilize AI to, take from people to use their voices. There's just different aspects to AI that I think need to be recognized that the industry kind of likes to clump everything into one. And it's really like the use of the voice, the use of like AI to create actual music itself. So like the underlying composition. And then, the use of AI to create lyrics. And there's three different issues. Like there's multiple issues that come up with all three of those facets. And we've seen all of them. And again, like for us, we're young attorneys. We're, dealing with a lot of millennial Gen Z, Gen Alpha talent who are very excited about this era. So it's like, let's help them figure out a way to properly license these things. Let's help them find a way to capitalize. So like, for example, YouTube launched that new platform and they're licensing voices. So it's like, okay, you can actually make money off of some of, some of these new AI tools if you're involved in licensing your works, but like, let's do this the right way, if that makes sense.
Are you familiar with I'm sure you guys are, the Elvis Act that just passed in Tennessee? As I understand it, that would eliminate that possibility of you using a clone voice on a demo.
Right. Well, yeah. And on the federal level, too, there's been talk and you know, draft bills and things like that that are coming up that are also stepping in to be like, hey, wait a minute, because it's definitely easy to see how it can turn into a slippery slope of issues with kind of videos, voices, people that are influential being manipulated and used, and kind of them, people seeing them saying things that they didn't actually say. And it just definitely is a slippery slope in that sense. So it's great to see, you know, states stepping in, and, you know, hopefully there'll be some intervention. But we always say also, a lot of times legislation, especially in intellectual property, so like in the copyright sense and things like that, it moves slowly. So as music industry professionals and people, you know, that are working in the industry, a lot of times we can't just wait for the legislation to pass and rely on precedent and rely on case law and things like that. A lot of times we have to factor it in ourselves and work it into contracts and try to have that foresight of what's coming. And so we can say like, hey, you know, fine, let's, if we're representing on behalf of an artist with the label, let's maybe try to factor into this agreement some controls over how they're able to use your name, image, and likeness and things like that. So we draft that into agreements, trying to take one step ahead and foresee where it's going and benefit of our client, rather than just like sit back and wait for the laws, because they will come, I'm sure, but it's just how quickly, I'm not so sure.
Well, the copyright board has already stated that you can't copyright anything that's 100% AI written. But the problem is they said it's different if a human is involved, but they don't say how much. Yeah. So therein lies the problem.
Exactly. It's and then it you know, we have to rely on precedent and kind of the cases that come up and how they're you know, how they come out and things like that. And so it's really a matter of time, I would say, but it's the technology continues to evolve in the meantime. So that's definitely where I think it's important for music industry professionals and people to kind of come together and, like, you know, make some decisions also.
Is there something that people don't know about what you do that you wish they did?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think that there are people who come up to us all the time and they're like, oh, you know, so like you're fighting for artists' rights, or you're like, they think that law and entertainment is always about disputes. And what we like to explain to, you know, the general public is that we are business attorneys at the end of the day. We are helping our clients cultivate deals and grow their brands, grow their IP, protect their IP, strengthen their, you know, careers. And so for us, it's really about what can we add from a value perspective? And like that goes down to, even we've had scenarios where we've negotiated on a producer agreement one additional point on, you know, the master side, and that song ends up, you know, becoming Grammy nominated, number one on Billboard charts. And it's the difference between, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for that client. So for us, it's again, like I said in the beginning, more than just we're reviewing your contracts. We want to sit here and think about what this deal is based on where you're at in your career and your space, and how can we add value? And I think that's the biggest thing that we're trying to teach people that don't fully understand, is like, we're here to add value to you and to be a partner, more than just, you know, paper pusher, as a lot of people like to call us attorneys.
Yeah, it's the difference between being proactive and reactive. Sometimes a lot of attorneys in litigation is reactive to a dispute. So if something comes up, if there's a problem, that's when you hire an attorney to help you hash it out or come to a settlement or litigate, whatever that may be. But our passion really lies in the more proactive approach, where we're on the front end of things and negotiating deals. Like as Bree was saying, kind of being more on the business side rather than the, okay, there's a problem, now we step in, to try to preempt those problems rather than coming on the back end.
When you're negotiating with a label attorney, it used to be that it was, and this is probably before you started, but it used to be that the deal was the deal pretty much. And you were discussing, negotiating over really, really fine points because you couldn't get any of the major ones. Do you find that they're more pliable these days?
Yeah, it's again really funny that you bring that up because we're working on a deal right now with an independent publisher who came to us on, you know, in regard to our client and said, we want to sign your client. Can you come to us with terms? And So we went to the drawing board and, you know, looked at past deals that this specific artist has signed and, you know, where this current publishing, you know, company is. And they're, you know, backed by a very renowned artist that I cannot name for confidentiality reasons. But we kind of had to go to the drawing board, and it was actually a really fun process in the sense that Alexis and I, you know, got to kind of help explain to the client, like, this is where we think we can go with this. And like, you know, the bounds are endless, really. And so after having the call with the client, it's really, I think, inspiring for the client to be able to curate a deal in that regard, which is what I was kind of referring to in the beginning. It's just an exciting time to be able to like, think about where do I see myself in the next 5 years, and how can I make that happen through articulating what I want in this deal? And like, you know, a typical publishing deal only goes through the generic terms, you know, what's the term, what's the rate that I'm getting, what's the retention rate. In this deal, it's like, we want to, you know, we want you to secure us in X amount of sessions, and we want you to ensure that there's two writing camps being curated per year. So kind of going into the specifics of like, what involvement do we want more than just like, what are the terms of a standard publishing deal?
And I think it goes back to also the saturation and the fact that there are so many independents popping up left and right, more so than there were 10, 15 years ago, when it was really just limited to the big players in the industry, where now, you know, as we were talking about before, there are other options for artists. So some of the majors are being forced to, and depending on how much they want the artist, about how much, you know, how much leverage the artist has, being forced to be a little bit more flexible with these terms, or because they do run the risk of them going elsewhere. And, you know, the independent artists, like Taylor Swift is a great example, started off as an independent artist. She wasn't signed to a major, and really look at, you know, it's insane what happened. So some of the majors don't want to miss out on those opportunities either. So it does provide that flexibility, which again is really exciting for us to be able to be a little bit more creative with deals and deal terms.
Okay. So you just mentioned something that prompted an idea in my head here, TikTok. So many of the record labels are finding their newest artists, or they were, on TikTok, and it was a treasure trove for some. That being said, not many of those have actually worked out to have long-term careers. For a record label, then, if TikTok is not supplying artists, it's not supplying money because they're not making anything off of it, and to some degree, the promotional value. Some question that as well. How do you see TikTok in the business today?
I see it as a launching pad, like kind of it's because you're 100% right. It's a viral moment. And so it's like a small snippet in time where, yeah, absolutely. People see their careers take off from TikTok and having a TikTok hit, but it can be very fleeting. So I think that in order to stay and capitalize on that, it needs to not just be TikTok. It needs to be, how do you turn that into, you know, more of a marketing campaign for yourself on other platforms that maybe are a little bit more influential, you know, expand it into Instagram or, you know, all these other places that potentially have more staying power than TikTok. Because yeah, like in TikTok, the next day there's going to be a new viral song. And so I think that, you know, like you're saying, the labels aren't necessarily putting all their weight on, okay, great, you had a viral TikTok hit, so we're going to give you some great, you know, term or deal, whatever. But I do think it can be used for an artist as a launching pad and a good way to get visibility and broaden their audience. But then it's up to the artist to then maintain it and take it elsewhere so that it has more staying power.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of emphasis on the last part of what Alexis just said, because we've had clients come to us who have a, you know, record deal on the table because they had one song blow up on TikTok. But then, you know, if the artist sits on that deal for too long, the label becomes uninterested because you have to act on that immediately. So it's a very quick side of the industry that if you don't get involved like at that moment, you know, it could be almost like your one shot was kind of lost. And then that's a real thing that we do see. So it is interesting. I mean, we have I guess you could call them digital influencers who grew a massive following on TikTok, who were never in the music space and are now able to pivot into the music space because of their following and are, you know, seeing success in this realm. So like Alexis said, I think it has a lot of power from the reach that you have on a global scale, which didn't exist prior.
What's your opinion? Is it going to be... Banned is not the correct word in the United States, because that's not what the legislation is trying to do. They're trying to, I guess, make it divest into a U.S. corporation. How do you feel that that's going? Is that going to happen?
That's a really good question. I think I would be surprised, but at the same time, there's a lot of things that have been surprising lately. I think that there's definitely things that have gone into effect, but whether or not it stays there, how it's going to be challenged, you know, whether there's constitutional arguments, like all this, there's many, many things that kind of go into it that I think it's a pretty complicated issue, and it's going to be interesting to see how it unfolds. But this whisper of banning it has been around for quite some time now.
I just read something right before we get on the interview here, that some of the former U.S. TikTok executives were saying that, yes, it's true, we actually forwarded information to the Chinese government. And that will be pretty damning if that's the case, I think.
Sure. Yeah, it's crazy how it's gone yeah. from being, you know, an entertainment platform, like a silly videos and things like that, to all of a sudden to like a serious information sharing between, you know, governments and things like that. It's almost mind blowing.
Okay, last question. Bree, let's start with you. So what's the best piece of advice that you either learned along the way or maybe somebody imparted to you?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think the best piece of advice that I've learned, I would say, since starting the firm, is that, you know, from a building a business standpoint, I guess this speaks more to that, is every mistake that occurs, there's a lesson in it. And I think looking for that is really important. You know, there's been, you know, moves that we've made or decisions that we've made that maybe weren't the best at the time, but looking back, they taught us such a valuable lesson, or were a building block for the next step, that really it's like, if you're going for it and you're really like following your passion and doing what you want to do, at the end of the day, like you're going to end up there. So I think like really just like for anyone in any space, really taking the time to think about something that you might point as a mistake and seeing like what you could actually learn from it and how that helped you grow.
Alexis.
That's a great one. I think for me, and this is something that I continue to try to live by every day, because I can be pretty indecisive at times, but that making a decision is better than making no decision. And you can always, you know, try to fix things or do something, but it's kind of like sitting on things can sometimes be more damaging than not. And as attorneys, a lot of times what our jobs are to try to give clients all the information and the tools that we can, and then have them make a decision from there. So whether that's, you know, signing a deal or not signing a deal, it really depends on the long-term goal, like what the goals are. And the same goes for us. It's kind of like, what is the end vision and how is it going to help you get there? And then, you know, go for it, take risks, and then, you know, you can always kind of adjust along the way.
Bree, you mentioned before about when you sit down with an artist, you ask them where they think they're going to be in 5 years, but how about you guys? Where do you feel you're going to be at in 5 years?
Yeah, so we've done a lot of business planning as far as like where we see Schwartz and Schreiber, you know, as a firm in the next 5 to 10 years. And the 10-year plan, I can tell you, is we really want to build a brand that's bigger than Alexis and I. And, you know, there's a lot of emphasis with attorneys in general on the attorney themselves. But for us, it's really about building a relatable firm for these, you know, these upcoming generations. We have clients that are in Gen Alpha, Gen Z, millennials, who are really doing some awesome, impactful things in the industry. And we want to be able to support them as they, you know, grow and become, you know, the next the next generation of entertainment. So for us, it's really providing a one-stop shop from a legal perspective to these clients. So, you know, we do IP work in addition to the general like music and entertainment work, but, you know, currently building out corporate counsel, complex corporate counsel, as well as litigation counsel, eventually, you know, someone on the estate planning side to help these talent as they grow kind of full encompass, how can we help you from a legal and business perspective? And that's where we're going right now. We're a team of six and we're really proud of, you know, where we've came thus far, but we obviously have a lot of growth to do still.
And we also, we recognize now that more than ever, there's so much overlap in the industry. So, you know, we started off being mainly music focused, but now we're seeing so much in film and TV, in technology and new media and social, you know, branding, all this kind of stuff. So we really want to make sure that all of that is encompassed as well, so that our clients are able to pivot and make these moves and go in different directions easily, and that we can have that support throughout the whole process. So that's a big goal of ours.
You can find out more about Brianna and Alexis at SchwartzSchreiber.com. That's SchwartzSchreiber.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOsinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at BobbyOsinski.com. There, you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's BobbyOsinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOinnerCircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOinnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.